it's hard to be cool and be like, I'm listening to Sleater-Kinney and we're in grunge and like Riot Girl and whatever. And then be like, I'm also really invested in this Victorian girl who's like a labor queen, but lives in a mansion and knows stuff about boating that those of us in an income bracket that I'm in do not, you know.
I did not know about boating. No,
it's tough to carry that duality. Hard to pull that off, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe Claire Danes could have done that. I mean, she's done a lot.
You are listening to Burnt Toast. I'm Virginia Soul-Smith. Today, I am chatting with Mary Mahoney, co-host of the Dolls of Our Lives podcast and co-author of the 2023 book, Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. Mary also writes the excellent new Substack newsletter, Landline, about pop culture. As a podcaster, author, and historian, Mary has spent the past few years investigating the origins of the iconic American Girl brand, the stories we tell ourselves about it, and the meanings behind that and so many of our other millennial pop culture attachments. All of Mary's work is also just super smart and extremely hilarious. So as we are going to discuss in this episode, I am a Samantha, and I have a very tragic backstory about being a Samantha, which we will unpack. I want to say that today's episode was very healing for me, and I hope it will be for all the other millennials listening who grew up on this brand and may have complicated feelings and experiences with it. Mary is really great at holding space for all of that. But we are also going to unpack the role that American Girl has played and continues to play in diet culture and modern narratives about bodies, especially girl bodies. And all of that is probably a lot more nuanced than you're expecting. So get ready for a few plot twists. Here's Mary, but first a quick break. If you love the conversation you hear today, I hope you'll order Mary's book, Dolls of Our Lives. And I hope you'll order it from the Burnt Toast Bookshop. The Burnt Toast Bookshop is hosted on the website of my local independent bookstore, Split Rock Books. Split Rock is owned by a cat named Georgie and my good friends Heidi and Michael Bender. And they are delighted to forever offer 10% off any book featured on the Burnt Toast podcast if you also purchase a copy of Fat Talk from them. So that includes books by Angela Garbez, Aubrey Gordon, Vashti Harrison, and so many more. Just go to splitrockbks.com and use the code FATTALK at checkout.
So I'm a historian by training. So I actually trained studying like how culture can be used as therapy, like specifically books and reading. But I actually got into history itself through American Girl. So when I was finishing grad school, a friend and I started a podcast now called Dolls of Our Lives, where we reread the American Girl book series and use it as a jumping off point to talk about history and pop culture. So that's probably what most people know me from.
Yes. And you have the new book, Dolls of Our Lives, which is just a terrific, like, everyone go read it if you haven't already, because it's fascinating. You will not be able to put it down. You will laugh and cry. It's great.
Thank you.
Well, of course, I know everybody who talks to you does this, but I am going to need to tell you my American Girl story. I think this is a service you're performing for millennials now.
Absolutely.
So I am older than you. I was born in 1981.
Okay.
So American Girls came out when I was like 8, I want to say. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. 1986. So you were probably 5. Yeah.
Okay. So I am a Samantha. And the story I need to tell you is how I was obsessed with Samantha. My mom is like a big feminist. I think she brought me up on like Mary Poppins, the sister suffragette song was a very formative text in my youth. Mm-hmm. So then Samantha was a very logical next text for us about, you know, her being part of the early suffragettes and labor rights movements in problematic ways, as you unpack beautifully in the book and the podcast. But I was obsessed with her. I wanted a Samantha doll more than anything in the world. At that point in time, my family was not super financially solvent. Like, my parents mm-hmm. had gone through a divorce. Like, there was no money for a Samantha doll. Cut to probably 1995 or 96, when my younger sister got Samantha.
Who do you two still speak? Or, I mean, what's the status of your relationship?
I mean, it was a rough moment for us. Uh-huh. My family's financial status had changed. And so it was possible to give a girl, an American Girl doll. I had all the books, but I never had the dolls. It was a big moment for me in my childhood of, am I going to, because my sister is almost 9 years younger than me.
Okay.
So it was like, am I going to, as a high school sophomore, take this child's Samantha doll for my own?
Wow.
Did I think about it? Yes. Did I do it? I did not. Was I mad when she also got the Samantha dress?
Ooh, that's tough.
It's a lot. It's a lot. I can now reflect on how Samantha is a complicated choice as an American girl to identify with. My mother certainly would have preferred me to be a Molly. She was steering me pretty directly towards Molly, and I was unavailable for Molly at that time. But I now, as an adult, do understand that.
That's a polite way of phrasing that. It's really interesting that you have a sibling who's like enough younger than you that you can kind of watch her go through a journey you had already been on, but with a different endpoint, you might say, like she gets it all, you don't. And kind of what that felt like for you. And also, it sounds like you were at a point when you didn't think you had permission to like maybe steal. That's one issue, but also like just have something that was geared towards a younger person. Like, I think now it's so much more normalized to want toys at any age.
No, I think like I was like, I've already watched my so-called life. Like, I've moved into my Angela.
Oh my
Chase
God.
Space.
Don't even get into that with me. That was like a time in my life, that show.
Right. So wow. Like, how do I go from like, I am wearing flannel and Doc Martens to I would like to wear the Samantha dress that does not come in my size because now I'm a teenager.
I mean, well, and that was also a moment too when like a year or two before Titanic, the movie came out. And I feel like that was also a big moment for like Samantha Core, to the point that there was a meme circulating that was like Samantha was the first victim of the Titanic. And like some people just believe that she died on the Titanic, which incidentally, she did not. Although there is a book about Nellie, her servant / friend, being on the Titanic, an offshoot book. But
oh, God. I never read that one. That was after my time.
That's a dark book. I'll just say that. Yeah. But, you know, it's hard to be cool and be like, I'm listening to Sleater-Kinney and wearing grunge and like Riot Girl and whatever. And then be like, I'm also really invested in this Victorian girl who's like a labor queen, but lives in a mansion and knows stuff about boating that those of us in an income bracket that I'm in do not, you know.
I did not know about boating. No.
It's tough to carry that duality. Hard to pull that off, I think. Yeah. Maybe Claire Danes could have done that. I mean, she's done a lot.
I wouldn't put it past her. And were I to cast someone to play like a teenage Samantha, she'd be on my list. I could see that for sure. Like Angela Chase era, Claire Danes, obviously not the, you know, mother and fully formed adult she is today.
Fair.
I do think there was something about Samantha, particularly because I think I knew that the dolls were like out of reach financially for us. Mm. Like, it's interesting that I picked the wealthiest one to be obsessed with. That's a whole thing. Although I do think, like I said, the suffragette movement was part of it. I should own that while I did not get an American Girl doll, my mom did help me develop quite a collection of porcelain dolls, which I think were oddly more affordable. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember she got one of, like, Joann Fabrics. I don't know if porcelain dolls were on your radar. I know Allison is more of the, like, doll collector of the two of you.
Yes, that's true. So I'm named after my maternal grandmother, Mary Margaret. She was very into porcelain dolls and QVC, which was like her gateway drug for porcelain dolls and the Christmas tree shop. I don't know if you know of the Christmas tree shop, RIP. It just went out of business.
I do. But I'm from Connecticut. Yeah.
Okay. So okay. Me too. So my grandmother bought me a lot of porcelain dolls that just kind of sat on my shelf. And my other grandmother is the one who bought me American Girl dolls. And I was really into the books more than the dolls, in large part because the grandmother who gave it to me was like very judgmental of the version of girl that I was. It didn't really sync up with what she had in mind. And so I think it put me off the American Girl dolls, even though it was such a privilege to have them. It's the only way I probably would have had them. So I do know porcelain dolls mainly as like creepy things that stared at me in the night in my bedroom.
I mean, I had a lot. And I do remember later having like a high school boyfriend come over and be like, your room is terrifying. Because they were like nine dolls staring at
me. Yeah.
And I was like, so you don't want to make out? What? I don't get it.
I'm sorry, what? Yeah. You're not into that? I mean, you're not into an audience?
Yeah.
They won't interrupt.
But cut to today, and I have a basement full of dolls in boxes because I have two daughters, and they are not doll people at all. They don't care. So what happens if you have a baby girl, the American Girl catalog shows up at your house probably before you've given birth? Like, I don't know how they know.
It's a Census Bureau thing, I imagine.
They know what they're doing. And so my older daughter did get very interested in the catalogs, like as a, like reading catalogs is just, you know, I mean, that's an American pastime for sure.
Yeah.
And did ask for American Girl doll when she was like four and then again when she was six. And both times I, of course, having known the deprivation of having a collection of nine porcelain dolls, but no American Girl doll. Again, this is my childhood trauma episode. So we got our first a Welly Wisher, which is like your entry level, you know, little kid American Girl doll. And then we got our Nenea.
Nope.
Never get played with.
Wow. Does she like the books at all, or it's just a no?
We did go through the books. Yeah. She liked the Nenea books. I don't know if we've actually gotten Samantha books now that I think about it. The books were more popular, but yeah, they're just, both of them are not doll oriented. You know, they want a million stuffed animals. They're very into animals. That's like their passion. I want to see them for who they are and support that. But it does mean I have currently a Nenea doll in a garbage bag that I'm trying to figure out where to donate, plus the porcelain dolls from my childhood packed in storage boxes because they don't want them.
Unfortunately, I've heard this before of, you know, parents who grew up without the opportunity to have the dolls, and either they get to adulthood and as like a gift to their childhood self, they get a doll as an adult, even if they're not parents.
That's for sure what I was doing.
Okay. And but then sometimes they get the gift and the doll and they want to share it with their child, and then their kids are just like, absolutely not. Like, I had a listener who wrote to us and was like, you know, I had this like really important moment when I presented a Molly doll to my daughter and she just like threw her on the floor and then walked away, never interested again. I'm like, wow.
I mean, they don't care is one part of it. And I also wonder if there's something about, I mean, like, I think I was being conditioned towards a certain kind of femininity and have like tried to be much more gender expansive with my kids and how we're raising them. And so they have more options, which is a good thing, obviously. But also, yeah, I mean, the dolls and the stories are magical and there's a lot to live there. Yeah. I don't have any further thoughts. We've now spent almost 20 minutes processing my childhood trauma.
Listen, I'm here with you. I get it. I mean, insofar as a childless person can understand, but I mean, in a sense, it's like, you're kind of showing that Pleasant Rowland, her dream hasn't necessarily played out the way she intended, which of course is true. Like, we can talk about all the ways that her brand became something that she never could have dreamed of. Like, you can invent a toy brand, you can't control how people play with it. There's this YouTube video that we write about in the book, and Pleasant is giving a talk at like the launch of Felicity. Like, picture Felicity dolls in like glass cages or cases, museum cases at Colonial Williamsburg. And she's basically like, my dream is that, you know, girls will get this doll and then they will play with it with their moms. And then that will be passed down to their daughter and so on and so on and so on. So it's like this very gendered female experience. But she's seeing this like generational cycle, like these stories and dolls are going to live forever in your family tree. And, you know, perhaps in yours, it's come to an abrupt stop. But like maybe a future generation will pick it up. Yeah. Like, who can say?
No, it's true.
I'm trying to paint a story of hope for you. Like, I'm just trying to, you know, whatever you need. If you want to be sad, you can also be sad.
All right. Well, thank you for that therapy session. But we are actually here to talk about American girls and the role that they've played in diet culture. And I thought one interesting place to start is how American girls were actually developed in very deliberate opposition to Barbie.
Yes. This is quite a tale because in some ways, when people hear about American Girl, they think there's real hypocrisy in Pleasant Rowland because she ends up selling her brand to Mattel, which obviously owns Barbie. And yet she began the brand in large part in angry response to Barbie. So she, as she tells it, goes to malls to find gifts for her nieces and is really appalled by what she sees at toy stores. She herself is childless, so she doesn't know this experience as a parent, but she's trying to buy educational gifts. She's a former teacher, and she's really appalled by Barbies, particularly because she views them as sexualizing children or like asking them to grow up too soon, specifically girls, by presenting, you know, an unrealistic body type. Barbie's an adult. And, you know, it seems at odds with what girls should be given as educational tools. I should also say she was very upset by Cabbage Patch dolls, which were really having a moment in the 80s when she was getting into this. And she called them ugly. That's her word, not mine. But she was like, they're ugly. And Teddy Ruxpin, which was a kind of creepy teddy bear that would read you books from a cassette tape, you would play in his back. Like, I put my Janet Jackson cassette there once and it kind of came on when I was asleep at night, again, with my porcelain doll's hair. And I was like, ah, like, I'm not the same since that. The version of me that existed before that moment is gone. you know, Teddy Ruxpin, like I've lived to tell. So, you know, there's this in the culture. And she's also coming up in a moment in the 80s. Like if you were alive in this time, maybe people remember this, like Reagan's president. We have this hearkening back to this imagined past where people are like, you know what? The 70s was wild, like disco, Watergate, huge discontent over Vietnam. Everyone's upset, like jobs are moving to the South and then overseas, the economy's flagging. Reagan comes in and is like, hey guys, I'm proud to be an American. And he's like trumpeting like all of these like pro-American policies that are largely hugely conservative and built on a vision of American history that never existed. So that's kind of happening in the background. So Pleasant's like, okay, Barbie has really unrealistic body expectations, sexualizing girls, and also no one understands like the power of American history. Like I'm going to be part of this.
God, that's such an interesting mix of goals and values. I mean, I think part of the reason I was on the porcelain doll train was because my mother definitely banned Barbie. I mean, I still owned a lot of Barbies. It's complicated.
Sure.
But there was a lot of anti-Barbie sentiment in my house for sure. And so I'm like, I can understand the body criticism and the unrealistic ideals. Like, I'm here for all that. But then to also be like, and we need to teach children the correct whitewashed version of American history.
Well, because she also, it wasn't just like whitewashed history. So she is inspired to create American Girl by two things. One, she goes to the mall and looks for a gift and is like, Cabbage Patch dolls are ugly and Barbies are a definite no. I should add, when Barbies were invented, they were inspired by a German doll that exactly looks like Barbie that was actually almost like a sex toy. It was sold to truckers at gas stations. So it was not something that was like, this is going to teach you the beauty of like being a woman or American history or like anything necessarily positive. Not trying to teach you anything. And definitely an adult. When Pleasant goes to the mall, like that appalls her, that whole trajectory. So that's in the back of her mind. She then goes on vacation. Now, how many of us come up with a business plan after we go on vacation? But she goes to Colonial Williamsburg, which is a living history museum where people pretend like it's 1774, I think. And she's noticing that this museum is really amazing in their dedication to recreating this time, but there's nothing that puts kids and their stories at the center. And she thinks she can get more people to care about history if you put specifically girls at the center. And that actually is a radical thought, because even like professional historians, we're not putting children at the center of any story in American history. So those two intentions of like presenting something that's age appropriate for girls and something that puts them at the center of the story, like that's really what drives her to make American Girl.
And I think that was what I remember feeling really transported by in the books. These girls, they have so much agency in their worlds that they're moving through and you feel really a part of their adventures. And, you know, sometimes they are doing absolutely wild things. Kirsten in the cave with the dead body. I mean, there's a lot that goes down.
I will never let this go. But the fact that, so there's a plot in the Kirsten books where her family's not doing well. Like they've moved from Sweden to Minnesota in the 1850s. And it's the winter. And she and her brother end up like hiding shelter in a cave during a snowstorm. And they find the dead body of a trapper there. And all of his pelts are there. And they're basically like, oh my God, we're going to steal this dead man's pelts and sell them. And that's when it's going to save the family. So like one, that's a real plot line. But two, and this is what I won't let go of. The illustrator decided like of every scene in this book, like we must depict the dead body frozen in the cave for children, like to really hammer home. He's dead.
Yeah.
It's like, whoo, wild choice.
But that was a pivotal moment for her character. So I respect it. I mean, we needed the visual. I get it.
She was like, I'm scrappy. The history of the West isn't what you think. And it's like, actually, you know, that narrative of the West is pretty traditional for that time. But yeah, woo, wild.
Yeah. Well, to bring it back to, I don't think there's diet culture in the cave scene. I don't think there's a close reading I need to apply there. But I do think it's interesting that Pleasant was appalled by the artificial beauty standards of Barbie, the unrealistic body ideals. And yet the dolls she designed are not fully inclusive. There is only one American Girl doll body type. And the girls are all thin and depicted in the books that I'm aware of. And as far as I know, there has not been a fat American Girl doll.
there has not been a fat American Girl doll. And, you know, in thinking about the design intention behind the dolls, like obviously not to be Barbie was one, but the main thing she had in mind were that they always be frozen at like 9 years old. Mary Wiseman, who helped develop Felicity, anecdotally told us that Pleasant shared with her that the doll mold was something that she was attracted to because it resembled her own face. So the dolls are actually resemble Pleasant in their face, but in terms of their bodies, the only requirement Pleasant had was that they be huggable by kids. But yeah, there is no fat American Girl anywhere in the canon and no presentation of like even a friend of or anyone else right in the world of the dolls who's fat.
So that's some real erasure. It's interesting too, because while I get the argument of we want dolls that are children for children to play with, 9 is a really interesting age because it's right before a lot of girls go through puberty and their bodies change dramatically. And while I appreciate wanting to give kids the opportunity to stay childlike and then keep enjoying doll play and that kind of thing, it's also doing a disservice to the fact that like some 9-year-olds already are wearing bras. Some 9-year-olds are getting their periods or going to have their periods very shortly. Like, if you look at what actually happens to children's bodies in like ages 9, 10, a lot of them are no longer in a child-presenting body, and yet they are still children. And it's anti-fatness that kind of makes us not want to look too closely at that.
I think that's 100% right. Actually, in preparing for our conversation, I was thinking back to my own, you know, development. And I remember still reading American Girl books when I was in fifth grade. And that's the first year I had a sports bra because I started to develop. And it was like, oh, no one in the books was talking about that. And it wasn't just the American Girl books. Like, no one was talking about that happening before, like, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, who's older. And right, I remember just feeling so strange because that was my experience.
And again, like when I think about kids today encountering the books, like we're seeing, you know, the population data is sort of murky and hard to parse out how much puberty has really dropped younger and how much was it we only used to study thin white kids. And now if we study kids of different race and ethnic backgrounds, we see body diversity. But regardless, as they're trying to diversify the dolls, there's certainly an argument that that should include way more body diversity than we see.
You can kind of look at the brand and see where they've sort of acted on feedback that people have given them about being more inclusive, whether of ethnic or racial backgrounds, geographically, where they set girls' stories. But I'm not seeing that they've ever been receptive or demonstrated feedback about that, which is seemingly a choice. And you just imagine what it would mean to have that and what conversations they've had internally about why they won't do it.
Or if they've had conversations.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting too for a brand that has all these like, because there's the historic dolls, but then there's also the like, make your doll look like you. So they very specifically market the idea that you can have a doll that looks like you, but not if you're a fat kid.
Right. And even that is like kind of a wild eugenics experiment. Like, I don't know if you've seen like the catalog page where it's like, get a doll that looks like you. And it's like all these like different faces of varying shades. And it's like, okay, I think I see what you're trying to do, but this is kind of like coming off a completely different way maybe than you intend. And they push diversity. Sometimes it just emphasizes how much they consider the norm to be like white middle class, which is perhaps not what they're going for, but it's kind of what's happening.
I hadn't realized until I read that in the book about the faces being inspired by Pleasant's face, how similar the doll faces all are. I think I thought they had sculpted a totally different Samantha face than a Felicity face.
I think she licensed a German mold ultimately to do the original dolls, but I know that the Samantha face mold and Molly are identical, which I still refuse to accept because to me as someone who's a Molly, like the Samantha is so different. But I believe
and
it's actually true.
And does it mean that Rachel Lee Cook movie was true? And if you take glasses off a girl, she's a radically different person?
She's all that. Like, yes, of course. Exactly.
I'm upset about
it's deeply upsetting. I mean, if you identify on either side of that divide, like, can I fathom myself identifying as a Samantha? Like, no. Yeah. But, you know, somebody wrote to me and was like, it's homophobic. You don't identify as a Samantha because obviously she's like the gayest American Girl doll.
Interesting.
I refuse to take that on. I mean, Molly wore jeans and saddle shoes. So that's kind of what spoke to me at that age as a young queer gal.
There's a gay read of Molly for sure.
I mean, there's gay reads of all of them if you want that. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that there's so much sameness there in the production and very little diversity. The only thing I could find where you see like a fat body is the most recent publication of the body book that came out in 2022, I think, that was very controversial.
Is this the Care and Keeping of You, that body book for girls, or there's another body book?
So there's another more recent body book that is called The Smart Girl's Guide to... There's a kind of like true crime story to be told about this, and I would love someone to get into the... to dig about this. But in 2022, they put out a book called Smart Girl's Guide, which was The Smart Girl's Guide to Body Image. And there's a bunch of smart girl's guides to like social media, like... self-esteem, like all of these different topics, and they're all very well done. And if you look at the cover of the body book, there is a like a fat body or like a bigger body than just like the normal skinny girls on the cover of the book. And I don't know if it's on the official page I sent, but it's on there. Here's a USA Today story about it. And immediately this book was controversial, not because of how it dealt with body positivity per se, but more because of how it dealt with LGBTQ topics and specifically like trans youth, like messages to trans kids about, you know, seeking affirmation and help from a parent or an adult in your life. And specifically saying like, if you don't feel comfortable, like talking at home, like find an adult, you know, who you can talk to about this. If you don't have an adult you trust, there are organizations across the country that can help you. That was like the controversial quote from this book. They were like, how dare this book, an American girl, tell my child to do like, you know, gender modification or like to suppress puberty and like all these things the book absolutely does not say. It basically says seek out support from an organization. And originally the brand stuck by this book. Like there's chapters called Love Your Body. And it's sort of is an evolution from The Care and Keeping of You, which is about a decade or so or more older that has very dated views on bodies, does not mention trans issues, does not mention queerness. So this book was a major update and I think in the right direction, but almost immediately there's this firestorm. People are like spamming the book page with reviews that are like, this is terrible. This should not be sold. Tragically, on the American Girl website, all these other smart guides are still being sold, and that one is no longer on the site. It's gone.
It's gone. I can find it on Amazon, but it is not on the American Girl website. That's fascinating.
So it's really sad because it seems as though somebody made an inquiry about this to the brand. I think the only thing they said was, oh, well, it's out of print, so it's being restocked, but it's never been restocked.
Interesting. And interesting that you wouldn't put The Smart Girl's Guide to Manners out of print. Like, let's keep that one readily available here.
But this book, which talks about body positivity and it's okay to question your gender and it's okay to be queer and all of these things that are totally healthy questions to ask about yourself at any age. And the fact that it's immediately taken off the market, the fact that they did support it and then they completely reversed and now they don't even sell it anymore. It's just so tragic to me.
I am mad for two reasons. I am mad about what happened to this book. I'm also mad about the timing of it, that I wasn't able to get this story into Fat Talk in my puberty chapter because I was writing Fat Talk in 2021 and 2022. And so it came out presumably after I'd finished the book, and then this whole thing went
I was
down
thinking about you actually when this all happened, because it was just like so prime for you to step in on this.
It's fine. I missed the story, guys. I missed this. I apologize to the listeners.
I almost didn't bring it because I was like, I don't want to upset you, but this is like...
No, I'm glad.
This is so your jam. Like, I need to hear you on this, like, because, you know, I just, when you feel such rage, you don't know what to do with it. And so, like, that's how I feel about this. Like, I'm just so angry. On a basic level, we can imagine what's motivating it, which is like this conservative push to just ban things they don't agree with. But I'd love your take on it.
Having a brand called American Girl is super problematic, as we are now understanding gender in radically different ways than I understand Pleasant Rowland did in the 1980s. But this seemed like a great opportunity for them to be pushing outside the binary and, encouraging kids to get support when they're struggling with big things doesn't feel radical. Having a book with, I'm looking at the cover now, we've got a fat girl, we've got a kid in a wheelchair. I guess I shouldn't even say girl because
we don't know.
But we've got like four kids very diverse and joyful. And this just looks like a great book that I would totally buy for my 10-year-old.
Yes. And the fat girl's at the center of the cover, which I think is so cool. Like, they've put her at the center of the story of the cover of this book.
Yeah, she definitely is in the center, which is great. And the subtitle, How to Love Yourself, Live Life to the Fullest, and Celebrate All Kinds of Bodies. Nothing about that should be controversial. That needs to go out of print.
Like, no. And even the gender-affirming piece of it, it's literally just saying, if you have questions, like, seek help from these organizations that are designed to give you information, not tell you what choices to make for yourself or your body, but literally give you information and support. And the reality is a lot of kids don't have that at home. I grew up in a religious family. Like, the conversations about queerness did not happen in my house. And yet, and this is like telling for people who think if you just censor information, your kids will never find it or it will never affect them. Like, I have two brothers. One of them is also gay. So 2/3 of my parents' children are gay. You know, their batting average is wild. Anyway. They got to us anyway. Like, how does it happen? How was I so converted so easily? And it's like, because of course it has nothing to do with outside influence. It's internal. Right. And, you know, it just makes me really sad that, like, as historians, I think a lot of historians want to tell narratives of progress, of things getting better all the time, which is kind of an unhealthy impulse. But this is an area where you can kind of see, you know, speaking of the 1980s, it's like we're kind of going backwards in terms of trying to control culture to make everyone live by some very minority view. It's not healthy.
It's super upsetting and it's super infuriating that American Girl caved to the pressure. I mean, it speaks to, like, I don't know if you want to call it the mollification of the brand or because we don't have malls anymore, but, like, you know, this does feel like Mattel feeling like we can't rock the boat in this way. I don't know where Pleasant herself stands on this issue. Maybe she would not have been doing anything progressive on this, but I can't imagine if there had been pushback to some plot point in a Kirsten book or a Felicity book or an Addie book or whatever, that she would be like, I'm going to just stop publishing this book. And it just feels like she would have been more like, no, this is the story. This is the history I'm telling, you know, for better or for worse, given the way she's telling the history.
I think they have a track record of letting the market influence some of their choices, like when they stop selling certain dolls or books based on what's selling. And unfortunately, that has impacted dolls of color, characters of color, like Cecile, who wasn't on the market for that long. But, you know, in large part, I think the people who are integral to the founding of the brand, from what I've heard anyway, are very adaptable and are willing to even admit, you know, missteps early days in the brand with some of the ways they presented stories or characters. Mm-hmm. Like, I've heard Valerie Tripp is incredibly inclusive and supportive. And I feel like if given the chance to even rewrite some of the stories she wrote in the 80s, she would do so probably in a more inclusive way. So,
that's cool.
Is this the Mattelification of American Girl?
Mattel also brings us curvy Barbie and gender neutral Barbie, gender creative Barbie, whatever they went with. I think what Mattel does about all of this is similar to what a brand like Old Navy does, where they identify that they can get a lot of PR and create a lot of buzz by doing something that looks inclusive. Like, Old Navy's like, we are launching a new special plus size collection and it will be in all the stores and all bodies matter and blah, blah, blah. And Mattel will do that with various, you know, pushing the envelope Barbie dolls, quote unquote.
Right.
And then when they get pushback or just when they don't do it well, so the core consumer for that new product doesn't show up, like with Old Navy, it's like the sizes are never actually there and it all kind of falls apart. They just quietly stop doing it. And I have a theory that part of that is it is a better business strategy for them to occasionally be able to make a big splashy announcement about doing the inclusive thing than it is to just like sustainably do the inclusive thing all the time. They want the PR buzz of doing it. They don't want to keep doing it.
I think that's absolutely true. And you can kind of see that with all the brands during like every themed month, like Black History Month and Target. Like, they're like, here's our Black creators and we're centering their products. And it's like, what would happen if you actually did this all year? You know, during Pride Month, same thing. Like, you know, I don't necessarily say I'm opposed to like rainbow sequin Converse sneakers, but
how could anyone be opposed to that?
I don't think it's humanly possible, but I just wonder what would happen if you just made it as a point of your brand. Like, this is an inclusive brand 24/7, 365. And it's not just a marketing ploy. And with that in mind, it's like they haven't even tried this as a marketing ploy.
This body image book feels like someone wanted to do the right thing and got away with writing this book.
And it's, from what I understand, a very different part of the company. Like they actually outsource the writing of these books to like freelancers.
So they probably had somebody who was like, let's do this, let's do it well. And then when it blew up and there was backlash, the company was like, just kidding.
Just kidding. We're not doing that. We're going to say it's a computer glitch. Like it's not on the website. The Manners book, that will never go out of
print. Don't worry. We have Manners for you.
Grandma, we're going to teach your granddaughter what fork to use. No problem.
And there is a book called The Smart Girl's Guide to Liking Herself, which I would be curious to find out like the timing of like, is that a replacement title?
Yeah. And considering how many adults I hear from who still turn to The Care and Keeping of You, which came out when we were growing up.
Yeah, it came out in 1998.
I mean, considering what an impact that made in people's lives, like we talked to a bunch of women who said, you know, my mom wouldn't talk to me about getting a period. One woman said, when I got my period, my mom literally like slid this book under the bathroom door and was like, here, like figure it out. Which like, what a terrifying thing to have to figure out by yourself. But
yeah,
so you can see the need for this in a world where we're also being increasingly put in charge of our own healthcare. And that's presented as some kind of like individual right instead of like late stage capitalism. Like these books actually do play a big role in people's lives when they're feeling vulnerable.
I do want to talk a little more about Care and Keeping of You because I think it's a really interesting text. I mean, I think there's a lot it does tremendously well. I was 17 when it came out, so it wasn't the puberty book I used, but my younger sister, sure, it's a hugely important text. And yet again, on body stuff, like on body size stuff, leaves a little to be desired. And I did dive into that for the puberty chapter in Fat Talk. And there's a chapter in it called Belly Zone, which does make sure to emphasize that there's a wide range of weights that doctors consider normal for any girl, depending on her height and basic body type. Red flag on the phrase basic body type. Okay. But then goes on to kind of both say, like, don't diet, it's not good for you. But then they say, well, talk to your doctor first to find out if it's necessary, which certainly implies that for some kids, it might be necessary if your weight doesn't match your body type or whatever.
I mean, it's not great. I think, like, just to put it in context, like, this was coming out in the same time period, I think, as the movie Heavyweights and other things that, you know, by the way, are making light of diet culture while also reaffirming it. So,
yeah.
I think that that was the moment that was driving this. And I'm not defending them in any means because this book has a lot of like issues. And I think the author has sort of acknowledged that at this point. But it does seem like they want to have it both ways in this passage that you shared. Like they want to both affirm like, you know, there's many different body types. And yet the basic body type phrase really jumps off the page because it does seem to at the last minute be like, but there is a real body type that you should be shooting for and that you need a doctor to tell you if you're there or not.
And it's interesting, again, in a book about puberty where kids' bodies are going to be changing so rapidly, there are a lot of common growth trajectories where kids get rounder for a few years, then get leaner, or a thin kid. This was my trajectory. I was a thin kid who became a small, fat adult. It's not like the size you were as that nine-year-old, that doll that Pleasant made, is going to perfectly mimic the size you are for the rest of your life. So it's not giving a lot of possibility for change, which you would really hope a book on puberty would be all about. Like, change is what we're here to do. Change is a good thing. It's normal. It's healthy.
I'm just rethinking my own experience. Like, I remember reading this book when I was like 11, 12, and that's when I started having chronic health issues that I've had like my whole life. And I spent a lot of my teen years in hospitals. And when you have GI-related problems, like so much is mapped on your weight that is made to seem the same as health. Like I lost 20 pounds in a month at one point, which is very unhealthy, which should seem obvious. But people in my life were like, oh my God, I was 12. They were like, you look amazing. Like, what are you doing? God. I remember going to a doctor and he was like, wow, your BMI is like perfect. You're amazing. And it turned out like I had this very rare GI disease. So like I was not healthy or perfect. And this person just was ill-equipped to diagnose me. But so much of weight being mapped onto health and aligned with health is so toxic. So it's not even just your appearance. It's using the language of health to manage weight or manage your expectations around what your weight should be. It can be so damaging, right?
those stories will never not enrage me. The things that doctors say to kids, particularly between the ages of like 9 and 14, like just a lot of shit goes down there.
A lot goes on. Yeah.
It's not okay.
Not okay. Yeah. I mean, I also remember the part of this book that's about breasts and like getting a bra. And I remember that being really fascinating because I had like really big boobs as like a sixth grader. And I was just so like paranoid about that. And I remember the book kind of just talking about weight in weird ways around that too, where I'm like, what's determining this? And I was like, I was getting obsessed, almost in eugenic sense, where I'm like, this is my mom's fault or my grandma's because they have bigger boobs. And somebody needed to just sit me down and be like, you're fine. And like, like put it under control. Instead, I had this book and like Oprah's episode. Did you ever see the Oprah episode where she was like, guys, I'm going to teach you all about bras.
Oh, yeah.
The revolution.
70%, maybe it was 60%. Oh, yeah. I don't remember what the stat was, but like American women are wearing the wrong bra and we're all going to get fitted today.
I mean, I look back and I'm like, how are we alive? Like when I got most of my health information from like Oprah and like this book.
And then like teen magazines my other main source. Yeah, absolutely. Which leads us to the American Girl magazine.
Yes.
I was fascinated by this chapter in your book. So my first job out of college was at 17 magazine. So I have some tales to tell
of
early aughts. Teen magazine culture was a time in my life that, yeah, I try not to reflect on too often, to be honest. But I've talked on the podcast plenty of times. Like, I spent a long time in women's magazines making a lot of really harmful body content. And 17 was this interesting place where there were a lot of really feminist editors on staff who were like, we need to help these girls with eating disorders. We have to help these girls understand about like consent and rape and, you know, and trying to do those sorts of stories. And then right next to it, we would be like, best bikini body ever. Get your prom body. Like, toxic nonsense. And I worked on both types of content and didn't, until far too late, really start to see the disconnect there. American Girl magazine, again, feels like a product that was developed very much in opposition to mainstream, like teen and tween girl magazines in around all of that.
Yes. So American Girl magazine, in a lot of ways, is like the radical pocket within American Girl. Like it had its own staff. It was in the main building in Wisconsin where American Girl was based. But, you know, having talked to one of the former editors, it was just a people who were like extremely earnest, really passionate about what they were doing, and really insistent on some core values that came from Pleasant initially, which is that there would never be a celebrity in the magazine. The magazine would only feature, air quotes, real girls who read the magazine. There'd be no like child models on the cover. There would be no conversations about boys, makeup, anything that might, again, age them out of where they were. And it had a lot of features that allowed girls to talk to one another in the pages of the magazine. Like there was this section called Heart to Heart, which is like the most primal part of this magazine I've ever read, where it's like one theme, like best friends. And then people would write in with like their own like very earnest, you know, experiences of it. Like, do you need to have a best friend? People would respond. Or they would cover, you know, girls who had different hobbies or interests. Like, it was just incredibly sweet. I could find like no main articles about your body at all, like other than like how to make a ponytail in different 90s ways, which I could never achieve, or how to do a French braid, which I mean, fishtail braids, I'll never get there. I've just kind of had to accept that about myself. Yeah. But, you know, they had features like 100 great things about being a girl. And I remember one of them was like the Rosie O'Donnell show, which is kind of a question mark, but I'm not going to question it from the distance of 2024.
At the time, it might have been one of the great things about
being a girl. At the time, yeah, absolutely. And I remember one of them was like, we could have a woman president soon. And I'm like, that's too dark for me to look at when I was like writing the book and going through my archive. And that one hurts. But there's also a section at the back called Help, which had advice offered by the editor in chief. And girls would write in with all kinds of questions. And it's really sweet when you think about the fact that a lot of them were like, I really am mad at my parents. They won't let me do whatever I want. And then their parents would have to help them mail this letter in.
I love it.
The advice is always, for the most part, really sweet. And, you know, in talking to some former staff members, they were really insistent that even the cartoons, like everything would be inclusive. There was more diversity in the depiction of girls in the magazine than in the main brand. They like always considered in making sure that representation of girls with disabilities, like all kinds of issues that were really on their radar, even and long before it was on the radar of the main brand.
So I'm looking at this picture you sent. So this one, I assume we're talking about the second letter here?
Yes, signed by Hungry.
So this girl wrote in, "I'm always hungry. I eat and eat, but I'm never full. Once in a while, I eat a huge dinner and I'm full for about 2 minutes. Then I'm starving. Hungry." Oh, I'm immediately like, what messages were you getting about your appetite in your house?
It made me so sad to read this. And this is why this section was one of my favorites, because they printed like very serious stuff and often like just really earnest questions like, "I'm afraid my parents don't love me because we had a new baby." But yeah, it's from 1998, if that matters. That's the year it was printed.
The response is, for 1998, pretty great. It says, "It's normal for girls to feel hungry when they're growing. You may be eating just the right amount for you. Talk to your doctor to make sure." I don't want you to do that, given how doctors feel about this, but okay. "Or it may be time to take a closer look at what you eat. Are you getting balanced meals? Your body needs protein like eggs and meat, as well as fruit, vegetables, and carbohydrates such as bread and pasta." Honestly, in 1998, to be willing to name pasta as a food we're allowed to eat feels a little radical. And then it does say, "If you're eating only spaghetti, for example, you will be hungry for the other foods you need. But if you're eating because you feel sad, worried, or afraid, ask a parent to find a counselor who can help you." I mean, I have notes, but they are the notes of 2024, you know, like for 1998, that's about as good as we could do, because at least it's not demonizing eating. It's not prescribing a diet. It's certainly better than I would have expected.
Like, what do you make of the, "If you feel sad, tell your parents you might need a therapist if you're eating because you're feeling feelings"?
I mean, my take is always like, you deserve tools. You deserve like support for your feelings. You deserve tools to cope with your feelings. Right. Eating is a perfectly valid tool for coping with feelings. Like, a lot of us eat when we're stressed or sad and need comfort. And that is a benign coping strategy. But they're not saying you should stop eating because you're feeling sad, worried, or afraid. They're just saying, like, also, you might deserve some support on that.
I went through, I want to say, like a decade of these magazines. I bought this lot that was from a funeral home, but they had like a decade of these magazines. Well, and this was such an important magazine for me. And I knew we were writing the book. So I went through a decade of them for this. And I didn't find anything that was about dieting, about any negative body image stuff. I mean, and I'm not trying to be an American Girl apologist. Like, I certainly am willing to call them out when needs be. But I mean, as you're saying, for 1998, I didn't think this was that crazy. Like,
for 1998, and also knowing the word count restraints this writer was under, because so at 17, one of my jobs was writing a similar advice column, which, by the way, they were letting the 22-year-old editorial assistant do. So something else to unpack, because we got similar questions at 17. I mean, we got questions about like abusive parents and like eating disorders and just like the darkest stuff you can imagine girls going through. And it would break my heart that every day we would get the emails because they're writing to a magazine instead of having someone in their life they can talk to. We did have a system, I will say, for 17, and I bet American Girl had the same system. We did have, at that point, a dedicated reader mail editor whose job it was to send resources directly to the girls.
Oh.
She didn't publish in the magazine at all. Her whole job was reading the letters, flagging the ones that the editors might want for content, but otherwise getting them, like, you know, and it was, I'm sure, a lot of form letters, but at least, like, you'd get some resources sent back to you, which was something. But yeah, we would pick out three letters to answer, and then I'd have 100 words to try to deal child's traua. You'd write a whole thing, and then they'd send you the layout back and be like, "You need to cut three lines. We're over three lines. Can you cut three lines?"
Oh my God.
Like, this was print journalism, guys. It was rough. Oh my God. So you'd be like, "What piece of advice should I take out so that we can fit it in the column?"
Oh my God.
Yeah.
How would you navigate that?
It was a lot. It was a lot. Part of my tenure there, we were edited by Atusa Rubinstein, who's somewhat well known for being like a very big personality editor, and edited everything with a pink pen. And so you'd get your proofs back covered in pink pen, and you'd cry a little in your office, and you'd eat some chocolate because eating with feelings is fine.
Absolutely necessary.
And then you'd figure out how to like include any useful amount of advice in this two-inch, like, look how short these columns are, like, in this two-inch square box.
It's like impossible. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like if I worked there, my advice would have been like, can someone help me? Like, here's my email. Get me out of here.
And then they'd be like, we're making the art bigger. So you're going to lose 5 more lines.
We're doing a feature on low-rise jeans. We need more examples.
We're gonna mostly just show torsos and not write a lot of words this month.
I mean, that was a whole moment in time.
It was a lot. So, Mary, what is your butter today?
I have two separate things, if that's okay.
That's great.
I'm really into comfort pop culture, things that make me feel good, and like eating chocolate when you're sad, which I also do. Murder, She Wrote is my number one recommendation forever because it always hits. It's a woman, you know, Angela Lansbury solving murders as a novelist,
nothing
also
better.
Being pursued by many men. Nothing better.
So she many men.
So many men. And she made a point of saying my character will never get married because I don't want to be tied down. And I think she's an icon for that. Yeah. Secondly, and this is food related because I'm a very like dessert-centered person, I read Barbara Streisand's memoir and the best moment in it, which no one is talking about, is she talks about training as an actor and being a method actor. And at times that was hard because she was playing opposite a man she was not actually attracted to. So it was hard for her to act attracted. So the way she got around this, and this is an iconic moment, is she would put a piece of chocolate cake in the wings behind him. So when she had to act opposite him, there was something she was really attracted to that she could use in the scene. And I'm just like, that has possessed my brain since I read it. And I can't stop thinking about it. And I'm like, my God, she's a hero for that.
That feels like some really devoted method acting. Mm-hmm. I wonder how the guy felt knowing that, like, I wonder if he saw the cake. I hope he thought about that. Yeah.
He probably needed that takedown, you know, ego-wise. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe not.
I think I'm going to do a food butter, too. I've talked about this book on the podcast before. It's The Snacking Bakes Cookbook by Yossi Arefi. And I recently made the loaded chocolate chip cookie bars out of this cookbook. And they are so good. Like, I made them a week ago. Obviously, we've eaten them all. I've eaten them all. My children don't like things with nuts and coconut. I mean, I love my children so much. I feel like this episode has come out as a little anti my kids. And I want to be clear that they have a lot of good qualities.
Okay,
but
great.
But their feelings on American Girl dolls and cookies with things in them are not their strengths. But they were delicious. They're like chocolate chip cookie bars, so kind of like a blondie situation, but with coconut and walnuts.
Oh, my God.
So it really feels like a substantial snack.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I'm really excited to make them again, probably later today, I think.
Okay, I love that for
you. We've talked about this.
I want to make that. Have you ever made Dolly Parton bars or like 7-layer bars? Kind of sounds
like
that, but better.
I love 7-layer bars.
Me too.
My mom makes those for me every Christmas, and I do love them. But sometimes 7-layer bars are so sweet, you can't eat too many. Like the sweetness can become a barrier at a certain point.
Yeah.
And these have like a little more of a salty texture.
And I know you're a Connecticut resident, so I just have to add as a food recommendation, Munson's chocolate, if you've never had it. Get into it.
I never had Munson's chocolate.
What? Okay, I'll
have
to send some
to you. What part of Connecticut are we? Maybe we're not. It's a tiny state.
It's a tiny state, but people have very strong feelings about different parts of the state. I'm from the Hartford area, so
okay.
I grew up in Wethersfield.
I'm from the New Haven area.
Live in Windsor. Okay, that's why. So you have better pizza, but we have Munson's chocolate. I'll send you some. It's my favorite chocolate in the world.
Okay. I now have to be angry at my parents about the lack of a Samantha doll and the failure to expose me to that chocolate.
Ooh.
My mother didn't work in Hartford for most of my childhood. So we'll take a closer look at that later.
I have stirred some things up here. Sorry to your mom. My apologies. I hope Virginia shares some of the Munson's with you. Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe that's just like part of the healing.
Yeah. Yeah, it might be part of the healing not to share it. We'll see. But yeah, I now live in the Hudson Valley in New York, but I grew up in the New Haven area. So shout out to Pepe's Pizza while we're here. And apologies to everyone who thinks that there's better pizza than New Haven, Connecticut pizza.
There's not. It's the best, for sure.
It's important to set the record straight. Mary, thank you. This was so much fun. Tell folks where we can follow you. What can we do to support your work?
Thank you so much again for having me. You can listen to my show, Dolls of Our Lives, if you want to hear more about American Girl. You can subscribe to my newsletter, Landline, which is about pop culture and history. And you can find me on Instagram at Mimi Mahoney. I'd love to hear from people.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to Burnt Toast. If you'd like to support the show, please subscribe for free in your podcast player and tell a friend about this episode and leave us a rating or review. These really help folks find the show so we can grow.
The Burnt Toast podcast is produced and hosted by me, Virginia Soul Smith. You can follow me on Instagram at @the_soulsmith. Our transcripts are edited and formatted by Corinne Fay, who runs @SellTradePlus, an Instagram account where you can buy and sell plus-size clothing. The Burnt Toast logo is by Deanna Lev. Our theme music is by Jeff Bailey and Chris Maxwell, and Tommy Heron is our audio engineer. Thanks for listening and supporting anti-diet, body liberation journalism.